Hello, I'm Katie Manning, and you're very lucky because you're listening to Gallifrey Public Radio. Enjoy!
I'm Chris from All Things Good and Nerdy, a proud member of the Gunna Geek Network, just like the show you're listening to right now. The opinions expressed are those of the individual hosts. Make sure you check out all the other great podcasts at GunnaGeekNetwork.com and get ready because geekiness begins in 3, 2, 1.
Dialed into Gallifrey Public Radio. We're a podcast dedicated to positive enjoyment of everything in the Doctor Who spectrum. Join us for weekly discussions ranging from Hartnell to Whittaker and well beyond. Your hosts are Jay Witten.
I choose Death by Scotland.
Keir Hansen.
Arun, Arun, Arun.
Charles Martin.
I got their first album, The Salty Butter.
And Haley Malley.
I used to be right next to a train track.
We travel through classic and new Who, explore the extended Whovian universe, and play a few games from time to time if we're left unsupervised. Oh, and a word on spoilers, we do discuss recent news, content that has been officially released, and the occasional interesting rumor, but don't worry. If we look too far into the future, we'll give you fair warning.
Welcome to episode 303 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where pride on your lawn care begins with taking control. You let those weeds know who's boss right up front and never surrender. Of course, when nature tries to get the upper hand, who you gonna call? A unit bombing raid, of course. I'm Haley.
I'm Charles.
I'm Jay.
And I'm Keir. This week we play a little, hey, what could possibly go wrong, botanical edition, when the Doctor and Sarah Jane have to once again deal with some overzealous scientists who are poking their expeditious noses into something well beyond their pay grades, in the Seeds of Doom, with a couple of tiers of would-be adversaries, a rather unusual score, and a nice pastiche send-up of the thing from another planet, we're dealing with another Hinchcliffe and Holmes special. So, as we always like to do, we will begin with our familiarity with this particular story. Haley, first time. Yeah, take this as a given. Yeah.
Never seen it.
But your impression of this now, unusual, I would say, for where we are in the stage, a six-part Baker story.
Mm-hmm. I don't know that I really noticed a place where it really dragged that I can think
okay.
of.
Okay, that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. Jay.
I've seen it before. Again, found myself all too often wanting to say the lines, feed me, Seymour. but I agree there. It was a bit better paced than we're used to with 6-part stories, though. There was the old trope of, hey, we escaped. Now we need to get back into the building. Oh, we got caught. Hey, we escaped. Now we need to get back into the,
Yeah.
It's not a trope. It's tradition.
It's an homage. and Charles, if you were to put some sort of a number on the number of times that you've danced through the hedgerow with this particular story.
In the pale moonlight?
Yeah, sure. Or any sort of light, whatever's convenient.
Mm. Easily 20.
Sure. Really?
Wow.
I first saw it in 1978.
Okay.
So, and remember, that was... well, I guess not that long after it originally aired. Thanks for making me feel old.
That means you put
everyone.
In a full work week watching this story.
Yeah. And my hot take on this is how you do a 6-parter if you have to do a 6-parter. You break it up into a 2-part story that's totally different than the remaining 4 parts.
Yeah, very true. So there you've got this pivot point where you could have walked away right there.
Yeah. It started off as the thing, and then it became the thing from another planet.
Yeah. So with this in mind, I mean, we're looking at something where I'm actually kind of curious. In this, do we have do we have two storylines really going here? I mean, granted, we have two possible resolution points, but is it just a continuation of the same storyline as far as being or entity X is bent on taking over the Earth and hero must stop it?
Overall, it's one it's one coherent story and two locations brilliantly handled, I thought. But you're right. There are kind of two storylines. There's unethical scientists, ministers, and henchmen, and mm-hmm. then there's and but that all most of that happens right at the very beginning, and then we just get into check out this weirdo millionaire.
Yeah. You know. All right.
And so, where's Unit Proper? Where are they?
That was going to be my question.
All right. Well, let's take that apart for a second, because obviously we cover our bases by saying, "Up, the brig is in Geneva." You know, right. It's like, oh, the doctor got knocked unconscious for this episode. He will not be seen. I mean, this is one of our go-tos.
Yes, he's hitchhiking the Appalachian. Was that the code phrase?
But my real question was that because the show had decided not to use our familiar unit crew at this point, or they had burned their bridges with the actors at this point?
No, it was just Nick Courtney was unavailable, and so they thought, well, if we don't have Nick, why get the other guys? So they just didn't.
Yeah, and that and the fact that and this is something I was going to wait till a little later in the conversation, but there is a fair amount of gory death.
Yep.
in this story, you start to get to know one of our unit soldiers. And you're thinking, all right, well, maybe this is shades of, you know, the Yates to come or something of this sort. And, oh, nope, he's through the grinder.
We're going to need another Timmy.
I was like, as soon as that happened, my first thought was, he wasn't wearing a red shirt. What the hell?
Yeah, right.
Well.
And there was the fascinating evolution of Scorby. This is Robert Banks Stewart's probably best character is. We watch him evolve from a completely heartless cartoon mercenary mm-hmm. into a person. It's pretty cool. You're almost rooting for him to get away at the very end.
I did not.
Well, it's one of those like you get to like him. He's actually becomes part of the team after a fashion, and you're like, oh, great, he's going to help him get away, and he's going to redeem himself, and it's going to be fantastic. And then he escapes and starts running through the stuff. And at the very end, he gets, and you're like, oh, no. Well, I guess he did blow up an entire base full of people, so he probably deserves that.
Yeah, yeah. I never really lost sight of the comeuppance for Scorby. But clearly, I mean, at this point, Chase, I find, is a fascinating villain. He is just straight up bonkers. Even before he really comes under the full sort of, you know, the mind spore control of the crinoid. So it's if I could just take, and I know we'll get to this, if I could just take the scene where he's playing his music for his plants.
Oh God.
And his henchmen have to sit there and say, all right.
Yeah. No, boss. That sounds great. Yeah.
When is he? When is he done? When are we supposed to clap? Do we clap now? If I clap early, he's going to vaporize me. Yay!
And this is a show. This is a show that has had plenty of eccentric fellows in it. And remember, there was contemporary shows like The Avengers that also featured eccentric rich people. Mm-hmm. So this is not an unusual thing. But then he just goes round the bed. Completely loses it.
Yeah. And I'm trying to think about the kind of statement that this is making, too, because we were thinking about 75, 76 and the rise of environmentalism. Mm. And yet you have an adversarial character here who is the consummate hyper-environmentalist. And I was really trying to, and I'm still to this day, trying to wrap my head around what kind of statement it was that Stewart was trying to make with this character, other than just saying, all right, well, this is topical, and everyone's just sort of really ultra aware of this delineation between those who are concerned about the flora of our planet and those who say, well, nature corrects itself, don't worry about it. But yet here's an individual who is firmly on the side of the CO2 breathers, but to the point of saying, damn the rest of these parasites. So I'm just really, I to this day, I am still kind of wondering whether or not there was some sort of strange subtext to the use of that character angle.
It may have been a commentary, might have been a commentary on people who, throughout human history, we've always seen examples of people who willingly joined the wrong side of history. Mm. But in the case of environmentalism, I think the point he was trying to make is that you can take just about any cause, no matter how good, too far. I mean, Chase makes a bunch of very, very valid points among his mad speeches.
All right.
But I think that was the point. You can take it all too far.
Right. Yeah. Goes back to our recurring conversation about the fact that the best villains are ones that that can see the justification in their twisted strategies.
Yep. Mm, right.
Well, there is one extra layer to the story that I absolutely love. Thankfully, with the number of times that I've seen it, I take long breaks. When it comes to season 13 in particular, I try to take long breaks. I was never really, really big on horror flicks and horror shows back in the day. So this was not my go-to Baker season.
Mm-hmm.
But as a result, what would happen is I would end up watching these a little more sporadically. There'd be a couple of year span before I would come around and watch them again. But I don't know why it is. I don't know what the block is in my head because I absolutely love the characters. I keep forgetting our little spy squad.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I keep forgetting Madame Ducat. Duckett. Yes. Duckett? No, it's Ducat.
It's Bouquet.
Because Sylvia Coleridge is amazing. I mean,
she's amazing.
Now, Haley, I want to point this directly at you because you got to see this character unfold from this tottering little weirdo artist into this, you know, almost, I don't really know how to describe her as far as her enthusiasm and her desire to be right at the center of things. You know, say, if you have any other missions, you know, I used to be in the artillery squad.
She kind of became like Helen Mirren in Red.
Okay. Yeah.
I can see the similarities, yeah.
She reminds me a bit of Julia Child, who would ever just, you know, had a cooking show and is primarily known for that. But every so often, she would remind you, I was in World War II.
Yeah, she's family. and she was actually involved with espionage.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, Charles hasn't been here for you to drop your Julia Childs.
I had to. Well, if you're going to mention her, I'm going to defend her. But okay,
defense necessary.
But then Sir Thackeray as well, who I think is equally, well, maybe not equally, but additionally charming in his attempt to feed information and things of that sort. I really wish that we had gotten more from the two of them going forward. I think that they could have been repeat, if not recurring, characters.
I think they should have had their own spinoff, like...
like Jago and Lightfoot.
Like Torchwood Prime.
I was going to say, I mean, Big Finish, come on.
If any of those actors were still alive, yes.
The mediocre adventures of Amelia Ducat. Where she's looking for all of these conspiracies where nothing's going on, and she's convinced that the man who's squeezing the bread a little too firmly is. All right,
it's like Murder, She Painted.
It's exactly it. Just hidden messages in her paintings of the thistle and such.
That's right.
All right. Well, we all seem to be kind of in agreement that there is something interesting in their control of pacing on this particular story. But I have to wonder if, me personally, I think the thing that stands out on this that keeps me engaged is that this was a story where I think Baker took a great leap forward in his willingness to push his character to extremes, specifically his anger. The Fourth Doctor's anger reaches an amazing pitch.
Yeah, dude, Action Doctor all over the place. Like, what the hell?
Well, yeah. I think, although I don't have any proof that this is true, I'm pretty sure, just looking at the story itself, that when Robert Banks Stewart started this story, John Pertwee was the Doctor. And I feel very strongly that this story was actually written with him in mind.
Okay. Which would explain a lot.
I would buy that. So, Kier, we saw the Doctor doing a thing you typically don't like in this episode, in this story.
Holding a gun?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a rifle.
Yep. Although, I will say that bothered me at first, too, until the point where Sarah Jane says, well, you're never going to use it. And he's like, yeah, but they don't know that. Like,
exactly.
That kind of gloss, like, it made it okay for me for this one period.
Okay, so, yeah. But that didn't bother me as much as something else, which it's kind of fairly typical in some of these earlier Doctor stories. We have a non-humanoid life form as the villain, so the Doctor seems very blasé about killing it.
Yes, I think there was sort of an establishment, the sheer terror from the first realization of what the first pod was, I mean, sort of set this baseline that the Doctor said, this is not something you want to tinker with. This is a scourge. And there is no reasoning with it, no containing it. It is as close to eradicate on sight as you can possibly get. Which again, yeah, I would admit is something that they've definitely walked away from in the decades that follow. But this was, yeah. I mean, maybe it's I hate to say this. Well, it's of its time. But if you're going to have a non-humanoid or some sort of a, well, it's a vegetable.
Mm-hmm.
Just keep throwing that
like
word
they
around.
Make a point of establishing that it's a sentient vegetable, which yeah.
Well,
is where
now,
the problem
to be fair,
in.
The Doctor's aware of the crinoids and doesn't do anything to stop to wipe out the entire race. He's just trying to stop the infestation of Earth.
Right.
So he obviously knows about them, and so therefore, apparently, they're okay where they are. But
you stay on your patch.
Yeah, you stay. Yeah, don't invade Poland. That's the key. Don't do it.
there are a lot of things here. I mean, take the moment where the Doctor spins Scorby's neck, and you think, "Holy crap!
Yeah.
He just snapped his neck in cold blood. That was fierce." And then Scorby stands up a little while later and goes, oh frickin' neck.
It turns out the Doctor often says he has no medical degree, but it turns out he's a chiropractor after all.
Yeah, exactly. He was just taking the...
He's got the DO, not the MD. That's why.
Here, Scorby, you need an adjustment.
Wait till he gets the mallets.
I should point out that a couple of interesting things. This was the last regular appearance of UNIT in the show.
Mm, true. At this point, it just becomes references and little, yeah.
And occasional characters, and then finally Android Invasion just, finishes them off for a long time. But the other thing is this is also...
Spoilers for Haley.
Jeez.
This is also Dougie Camfield's last direction. This is the last time he got to direct.
Very true, yeah. So we're looking at a bit of a transition. Well, we are not done with the... with the homages and the pastiches and things of that sort, because there's quite a bit left in the Hammer House repertoire for Holmes and Hinchcliffe to play with, but this one is particularly adept. I'm trying to put my finger on exactly what it is that makes this less of a tip of the hat to a particular genre and more of a, you know what, we've got our take on this, and we're going to do something a little bit more intense or different with it. I still haven't quite cracked what makes it feel a little different. I think it might be the tiers of adversaries, that you're not entirely sure who you're up against at any given moment, which is something that requires a little bit more viewer investment and thought than your typical straight up horror flick where the baddie is the baddie. You got the monster on the hill and we've got to take it down and call in the cavalry. So this has a little bit more thought and a little bit more audience care involved. Maybe that's it. I just don't know if that's quite the
I think some of the credit for this script actually goes to Robert Holmes as well, who's the script editor on it. There's a lot of his trademark subterfuge throughout it. Mm. But certainly the cast were top notch. The hallmarks of the Pertwee era were all there. Incompetent bureaucrats, don't know what's going on under their own noses, corruption, scandal, and villains who are not just cartoon villains. I think that's all, that mostly may be Robert Holmes, but But in particular, the fact that, yeah, like Keeler, for example, starts off as maybe a less brave Scoraby, but, you know, is his partner and has done jobs with them and with him before, you know, but then he gets turned into the plant, and it's horrifying to watch. The costume and the makeup are a very high standard here as well.
In terms of just sort of walk away takes on this, or your impressions on the story as it fits in with sort of the landscape that they've been creating here in season 13 specifically. Haley, I'm kind of curious to get your take on this, because we've been seeing them jump around a number of different, clearly hat tips to different genres and different story premises, call them homages or whatever you want. But as far as this particular rather violent, rather high action, rather intense at times, and notably longer overall story, where would it sit as far as your rewatchability and recommendability?
I could rewatch it. I don't know that it's one that needs to be recommended, though, because again, it's one of those types of stories where it's enjoyable to watch, but I don't know that it does a lot to build on a base of what you need to understand classic Doctor Who.
Okay.
Mm.
And I kind of think it's a little more violent of an episode than you typically see in Doctor Who, so it's not a good, like, representative, this is what Doctor Who is like type of story.
Mm.
So I'm going to say rewatchable, but not necessarily recommendable.
Okay.
I see. In terms of, you need to see this to help understand what's going on.
Right. Like, yeah. If a new viewer was coming to you and saying, what episodes do I need to see?
Yeah. And there's times...
all of them.
Well, yes, you're speaking to a completionist. So you don't have to explain to me the all of them concept.
But we also do, from time to time, we try to differentiate between recommendations for people that are trying to build an understanding of classic Who as a whole, just mm-hmm. a component. I want to know where the show has evolved from, versus those people who say, I want to know a little bit about each of the doctors. So I want good representative stories of what each of these previous iterations have really stood for and contributed to the pantheon. So yeah,
I would certainly put this in my list of some of the best six-part stories.
Well, yeah, but the six-part stories...
Somebody came to me and said, what are the best six-part stories? This would probably be on the top 10.
You know what I always say about stories that are more than four parts long? This could have been a four-part story.
Yeah. Well, and indeed, the production team was very well aware of that by this point.
Yep.
Especially having some of them having come through the Pertwee era. So, yeah, that's exactly why I think they broke it up into a two-part story in the Antarctic and then a four-part story.
As a means to sort of give a clear delineation for the audience to cool off and then jump back in? Or are you saying that in case they had to, for whatever reason, on rewrites or subsequent edits, cut it into two stories?
Well, I think the backstory on this was that they discovered that this was going to be a six-episode slot, and they didn't have a six-episode script. And so I think Holmes mostly wrote those first two parts. But the however it worked out, what happens is that if you join on part three, you get a reprise of everything that happened. So you're fine. So you can just carry. You can just walk in on part three and carry on.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, Jay, where are you on the rating scale?
Rewatchable. Yeah. I mean, it's fun. There's a lot of stuff to be gained from it. It's long enough that you do. If you haven't seen it in a while, there's things that you forget. So it's fun to go back and rewatch it and be like, oh yeah, I remember that part. That was one of my favorite. But I agree with Haley. If, as far as recommendability, there's not a lot that I would sit down and say, you know, if somebody was coming into to New Who or coming from New Who, or even someone that was just like, give me a sampler plate of the Baker era. Like, I can't see putting this on there and being like, this is a good one for XYZ reasons. It's super long. It doesn't really add anything to the overall story. It's very kind of standalone on its own.
Yes.
So that I don't really see any reason that somebody should seek this one out unless it's just, go through it. The only recommendation that I have for people is do what I did and set your iTunes to 1.5 speed to watch it.
No. No. What? No.
Just FYI, 1.5 times speed is the fastest you can reasonably watch a Doctor Who story before it becomes very difficult to understand the dialogue.
That's Doctor Who and the Chipmunks. No. We'll do it.
It makes the Thresher sequences terrifying.
It really does.
Yeah. Well, okay. I'll give you that.
They're moving
really
a lot quicker than you think they would.
But the other thing I would say about this is that if you're searching around for stories that don't have a lot of backstory on them, you know, that aren't deep in the mythos, then, you know, Kier knows this story, but that's how I got my wife into Doctor Who. Mm-hmm. We were dating at the time, and I needed to pick out a story that had no back references because I wanted her to watch the thing, not have to explain who the Daleks were. So as it happens, I picked Mask of Mandragora from this very season.
And you didn't pick the Gunslingers?
Well, it's only because there isn't one called that episode. It's called The Gunfighters.
Whatever.
But, yeah, anyway. The
the one with the song.
That's how memorable it is to Haley. All she remembers is the fact that they keep singing that coda over.
We watched that like a year ago, didn't we?
Yeah.
Year and a half ago? Jeez.
And she's still got it stuck in her head.
I didn't show her The Gunfighters because I wanted her to like me. And, and I didn't want to show her a six-parter, you know, right up front. But if the rules had been show me a six-parter and it can't have any backstory, this would have been a good choice.
Okay. That's a very careful set of conditions, but
it has one of the best writers for the show, one of the best producers for the show, one of the best directors for the show, Tom Baker and Liz Sladen really clicking as
a
team.
Oh, they are a machine at this point.
And just enough unit without having to go into what's all the thing about unit.
Right.
So it's good for that too.
Yep. And Scoresby. As long as you got Scoresby, everything's going to be okay. All right. Well, we could talk about this for considerably longer, but we've got some interesting stuff that has evolved over the course of the past week that we want to be able to get to. But before we get to the news, there's something that I guess you would normally categorize with the news, but it sort of sits on its own. So if you'll indulge us for a second here, we want to talk for a moment about the essay that was dictated, right? Straight up dictated by Jodie Whittaker. I feel directly addressing the viewers, and by the viewers, and I'm not giving, you know, capital V on this or anything of that sort. This is just speaking out to anyone who is either familiar with the show and wants to see where it's headed, is unfamiliar with the show and wants to know what all the hype is about, or has walked away from the show sometime in the past and might want to know why it is that everyone's getting all up in arms again. It's a very interesting conversation, and I'm hoping everybody's got a chance to read through what she had to say. Was there anything that you took away from this that you found particularly striking coming from your lead actor to make these sort of statements? And in this sort of extended format, I mean, this is beyond just the usual kind of press junket Q&A sort of thing. So what was your take on this?
I like that she's saying a lot of the things that we have been saying since
this
the announcement.
This is nice to be validated.
Funny that.
Yeah, she talks about the nature of the show is change. Young boys can have women as heroes in their lives. And like the show can also bring in new viewers. It's not all for the old guard.
Yeah.
I liked, I thought that her enthusiasm and passion for it carries through even in this written essay. She is really excited. She is aware of the mantle that she's taking on, and she's absolutely thrilled to be there. Yeah. And that sort of passion really wins over people who aren't, you know, dead set against the whole idea, which is kind of ridiculous in 2018, but never mind. I noticed that the essay was entirely gender neutral. Actually.
Right.
So, I think that's the approach they're going to take.
which is a conscious effort, which needs to become it goes beyond the point where you even recognize it. So that, I mean, you look at, there's a particular quote that I've been latching onto, and every time I pulled this article up, and it was a conversation with IGN, just for sake of reference, so we'll make sure that we include this with the rest of it.
By Terry Schwartz. Yeah.
So she says specifically, the show wouldn't be the success that it is without embracing progression and change. Sound familiar, GPR listeners? And I think that that's what this is fundamentally about. Why it has a fan base from all over the world, all different cultures, why it speaks to people from everywhere. I know from every single time there's a new doctor, there's always going to be people that are maybe disappointed that their previous doctor is not returning. But that's why this show is so exciting, is because you can never predict what's going to happen. So therefore, it's never boring. And that goes back to, I don't know how many conversations we had about, you know, the cycle of the new doctor, or maybe just the matter of the falling into patterns of complacency, or is this becoming formulaic, and all these things that we've discussed over the years. I was particularly pleased to hear that she admitted, well, I'm a new Whovian, you know.
Yeah.
So maybe she's starting to work a little bit of the back catalog. Maybe not as enthusiastically as Tosin Cole is trying to do right now. He's trying to absorb it all. But she owns that and sort of sees that as something that she can leverage to come into this sort of wide-eyed and enthusiastic.
Yeah. There's also a lengthy section in the essay where she talks about meeting a fan who's not well, who's ill, and talks about the fact that this show means a lot to a lot of people at all different walks of life really comes through, that she's very aware of this and is absolutely stunned at the power that this TV show has on people.
And the thing to remember is that she has been through the entire filming process for Series 11 at this point. She's done all of the hard work. She has hit, like, she's hit the points that make people question if they want to continue doing a job. Right now, the only thing she has left is the good part of enjoying it with the fans, meeting the fans who are now excited about this stuff. At this point, she's still meeting a lot of resistance from people who haven't seen her do the job yet, who refuse to give her the chance because they haven't experienced it yet. And for her to be this upbeat and positive about it after going through everything that she's been through up to this point tells me that, I mean, she's absolutely the right person for the job.
Yeah.
And if there was any doubt, there's a video that accompanies this essay on IGN's site of her surprising fans who are in the middle of taping messages to her about how excited they are and what her being a woman means, what just being the new doctor means for them. And then she sneaks up on them from behind. And there is no way you could dislike this woman after that.
My personal favorite from that, we were going to discuss this during the news segment, but my personal favorite from that clip, and it only runs about 2 or 3 minutes or so, is the family where you see the father. You've got the wife just kind of, claps her hands to her mouth. The daughter turns around and just kind of, the jaw drops. The dad starts leaping up and down and squeeing.
Yeah.
Hopping.
There's another woman who was in the middle of taping. And this is the thing. The video works on two levels. First of all, listen to what these fans are saying.
Yes.
As their message, without them realizing that Jodie's right behind them. Classic horror movie cliche, but those messages are really, really powerful. And then Jody's there, and they just lose it. One woman just starts fanning herself.
I'm losing
my mind.
If you needed any further reassurance, and it's another thing, maybe I'll include it in the notes just as a quick point of reference, but I'm sure that you folks have seen it floating around there. Jodie also did a quick little statement with a Stylist magazine where she was where they handed her a series of reaction tweets to her announcement from last year.
Oh, yeah.
And it's
not all as pleasant.
No. But a couple of them were from satire accounts. So yes. They were, and she took everything on the chin. She had a great laugh with it. And it just gives you even further reassurance that she is so ready and she is so prepared and she is so qualified, if not overqualified, to take this role on. And it's going to be a hell of a lot of fun. And guys, we have less than 2 weeks to start enjoying this.
It's so exciting. I'm over here in Victoria, BC, organizing a showing, you know. Thanks. Mm-hmm. Well, we'll talk more about the showtime in a minute, but
yeah,
we're organizing a gathering so mm-hmm. that we can all watch it together.
Perfect. Well, then why don't we just start leaping into the news now and start taking this stuff apart? Because we got a few more things we want to address tonight.
Yeah, sounds like a plan.
Okay. Well, let's without getting too far ahead of ourselves, let's take care of a couple of things that we just that I want to make sure that we address. Poor Bradley Walsh. Okay, he's a comic actor.
He sings well.
He has a lovely singing voice. He is entertainment personified.
Yep.
But the man does not want to talk to a tennis ball on a stick.
Well, as this very amusing article on the Radio Times had talked about, at that point they hadn't decided what the monster was going to look like, so they really couldn't tell him. You know, it's over here, it's this high, but that's just about it.
Just trust us, Brad. It's going to be horrifying. All right, just trust us on this.
But this is just going to show you what a consummate actor he is. So, mm-hmm. But it's so funny that I don't know if there was some sort of a strategy to the fact that and I'm sure they all probably had this sort of experience, because it doesn't matter how, you know, what a veteran you are with doing, oh, I've done so many sci-fi films or this, that, the other thing. If it's difficult, it's difficult. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're being given a minimal amount of information, you know, and the guys from over at Double Negative have not said, okay, it's got big wavy arms. By the way, there are 8 of them. It's got tentacles. It has laser beam eyes. It's red. It glows. So it's very bright. So you need to squint. If they're not giving you these things to work from, then, you know, there's only so much you can do. And we're going to clean up the rest in post. But the fact that they gave this to Bradley to say, hey, why don't you tell them about how difficult it is? It's almost like, tell the tottering old fool to come out there and say, I had no idea what was going on half the time. They told me to cringe from something. I'm looking at my knees. I don't know.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. It turned out he was looking the wrong way on this pivotal scene. So the rest of the crew are going, to the left. And he's going, to the right. And it just looks odd.
Or it could be greatly comedic. He's so terrified, he doesn't know where the danger's coming from.
I have a suggestion for Bradley, though, here's, and the production crew. The next time this happens and you're not quite sure what the monster is going to look like yet, on that tennis ball that you make the actors focus on, just write the words Brexit on it, and they'll know to be terrified and horrified and appalled. There.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Well, wanted to make sure that we took a moment to give some serious props to a friend of ours who is an exceptional writer for Den of Geek, Katie Burt, who has published a number of really insightful articles about some of the reaction and anticipation for Series 11. She got the chance to do an extremely deep dive on the research into some of the writers that we have for this season that we, particularly here stateside, aren't as familiar with. So it helps us considerably to have this kind of a who's who rundown and a description of their body of work that goes so far beyond what Jay Haley and I talked about.
She spent as much time on each writer as we spent on all of the writers.
Precisely. Yeah. But is able to also put all of that within the scope of here is what the contribution could potentially be going forward into the season and beyond, and what it may mean for the writer themselves in this stage in their career and so forth. So it's a fantastic labor of love, and I chatted briefly with her about it, and she was just pleased to just go through the journey of assembling this because it gave her so much better of an understanding. But we get to vicariously, you know, right of the coattails of all of her work. So make a chance.
That's what we excel at.
Exactly. That's all we're here for.
And profiles of the new directors and the profiles of the new guy in charge of music. Yeah, I mean, it it's worth your time to dig into who's making the show these days.
Absolutely. Yeah. And while we're not making a whole lot of mention of the fact that the screening that took place in Sheffield this night as we're recording, and everyone that had turned out for that event, the excitement level over and the amount of attention that was being given to everyone that walked that carpet, whether they were principal cast or anyone involved in the creative process, they are all getting a massive amount of love from the fan base and from those who were in attendance, and damn those people for getting to see what they've seen already, but whatever.
Virtual, you know, shaking of fist at sky.
I'm not bitter, but that cloud over there. Well, all right. Let's dispel a myth, shall we?
I've got to say, this was hilarious when I saw it. I'm like, wait, really? There were people that really?
Well, come on. You've got a kind of a badass looking jacket, a backlit, you know, very strategically backlit, some sort of a laser gun on the hip, and a bit of a spiky uppy hair. Could have been anyone.
Could have been a certain someone.
Yeah, if you're desperate.
If you really want it.
Well, you know, I love humans. Always seeing things that aren't there.
It is actually not Captain Jack, no matter how much you want it to be.
Yeah. Even though a lot of people wished really hard at the exact same time, it didn't make it happen.
Does not.
I will say, though, that Chris Chibnall, who otherwise did an article about, you know, some of the things that he wanted to bring to the show, and it's a very reassuring article if you haven't seen it, but he phrases his words very carefully, as you would expect. Mm-hmm. And so when he said no new monsters, you know, he didn't rule out no returning characters whatsoever.
Well, he had said recurring characters, but that was getting people into. I read an interesting article a little earlier today that was sort of playing devil's advocate. It might have been Hugh Fullerton that was writing it because he's had a lot to say about this lately. But it was saying, well, Susan.
isn't a recurring character, really.
Right, or...
Or I interpreted that as he meant no new recurring characters. In other words, people that we see this season, other than the new best friends, won't be back.
Correct. Or there could be things like saying, well, Missy won't be back, but if Missy regenerates, then that's not Missy. Right. And all these sort of things, you know, mincing words. But at this point, the desperation semantics are at an all-time high, which is why you get something like this backlit silhouette character that has a glowing pistol on the hip, and people immediately jump to time agents. Mm-hmm. What's wrong with Captain John? What if it was Captain John?
No, his hair's not that spiky.
Yeah.
Also, I think Jody was quoted somewhere as saying that she's Vortex had to learn how to say Vortex Manipulator, and who else could that be?
River used a Vortex Manipulator.
Yep.
Yeah. Actually, I'm hoping it'll be Simon Fisherbecker. Go there.
Jeez.
So the myth was dispelled by the person who it actually was in the photo, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
An actor correct. Named Sean Dooley.
Yes.
So he ruined the surprise for everybody. So hang down your head, Sean Dooley. Oh, you don't know that song, Hang Down Your Head, Sean Dooley? No,
I don't
okay.
know.
Okay, tough.
Wait.
Yeah, cool joke, bro.
You know how old Haley is, right? She's like half our age. So the last thing that we just want to drop on you is just a real passing thought, just in case you're curious. I mean, it's nothing major, but if it does matter to you at all, we think we kind of know when the premiere is going to air. But other than that, it's peanuts.
Not like we've been waiting.
No.
Plus, we called it.
Yeah, we did kind of call it.
Let us bask in our rightness.
Yeah.
Well, we called an aspect of this, and here's where I'll say that we had somebody who how was it tracked down? Someone who had done a digital subscription saw like a promo slide that went by that mentioned the airtime for BBC America, and they just, you know, sort of work things backwards. So we know now that at least within the UK they have announced that 7 p.m. Their Greenwich Mean Time is going to be their air point for October 7th. So the question was, well, what's the BBCA going to do? What's everyone else on the planet going to do if the UK is going to be watching this at 7 p.m. on Sunday nights, which I think is a great, great time slot, particularly for the premiere. Now, and bear in mind, this is not saying that this is going to be the fixed time slot going forward.
Right. This is just right. The premiere.
Yeah, because BBC loves to move stuff around by 15, 20, 30, 50 minutes here and there as week to week provides. But for a 65-minute premiere episode, I think this is ideal because you're going to get a lot of your teen and preteen viewers in there as well, which will be a boon for numbers. So the question becomes, hey, so North America, you know, hi, how are you? How's things been? Great. When would you like to watch Doctor Who?
And right they
now. Say, oh, now, please. Yeah. How's now? So if they're going to do a global premiere, and that's my big takeaway from this, is because we're looking at it from the state side, or you know, or I should say the North American side, and saying, all right, well, they at least frame this within a 2 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. I never know where we are. At that point in October, it's still daylight time, right? Yeah. It doesn't become standard time until mid-October. Whatever. God, freaking time zones suck. Anyway.
We're getting rid of them up here.
Oh, stop rubbing it in, man.
Look, who's got a better country than us? Blah, blah, blah.
Of course, I should point out that we have one province that insists on being a half an hour later than the other provinces.
Is it Quebec?
Not an hour, a half hour. Because that's Newfoundland.
Oh.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
So if we base everything and sort of work your clocks around on a 2 p.m. BBCA Eastern broadcast time, now we got to wonder, okay, will rebroadcasting or alternate time zone Pacific, are they going to get it at, you know, whatever, 11 a.m. or whatever? So we have to wait and start seeing how things start showing up in people's DDRs. And such, you know, or Haley, let us know what you start seeing there from mountain, weirdo Arizona mountain central, whatever the heck time you are.
Mountain Arizona standard never, time.
Mountain standard time, man. Correct me if I'm wrong. Arizona is one of those weirdo states that doesn't recognize.
Most of the state does not recognize daylight savings time.
Oh, my God.
There's like one
hurts.
County that does.
Oh, oh well, you've won up Newfoundland. Congratulations.
Yeah, nicely done. This is like people saying, what was the old George Carlin joke? That was like, you know, in New York, it's 5 p.m. In Paris, it's 6 a.m. In Newark, it's 11:42. Anyway, but my question is, so it sounds like they're going to do at least for the premiere, they will do a global, which means, hey, all of you in Australia who are wondering, are we going to get the shaft again and have to watch this on Monday? Maybe not. And so forth. And then the question becomes, what's going to happen going forward? But this, at least definitively for all of your premiere parties, set your calendars. Yeah, well, we're all set.
Didn't they do this a few years ago? They did like the global premiere of the season and then the rest of the series. It was like, you know, everybody sees it at 7 p.m. their time or something like that.
They did a global simulcast of the 50th.
Okay, yes. That's what it was.
And occasionally, I believe historically they did Christmas episodes.
Okay.
That you could catch both in Europe and North America simultaneously. Just those two markets. I don't know about globally.
Okay.
And for those of you who can wait just a bit, they're going to be showing the premiere episode of The Woman Who Fell to Earth in cinemas in America and Canada.
Yeah, just a few days later. So, yeah. I should say rewatch, because you know you're not going to wait and say, no, guys, don't talk about it yet. I'm waiting to see it.
I'm
going to
stay
screen.
Off of the entire internet for 3 days.
But it's a wonderful experience. I've gone to some of like Peter Capaldi's debut episode in cinema, and it's just great. First of all, you get to meet a bunch of other people that you didn't know who are also Who fans, and so therefore they're all your new best friends, to borrow a phrase. And you get to see it together, so the laughs, the tears, the whatever emotions get pulled out of us that we'll all experience together, and that's, oh man, it's just the best.
Yeah, that is going to be. I have to second that. I've caught a number of Phantom Events that they've done for, well, from the 50th and beyond. But that point specifically about knowing that you are in a theater full of ultra dorks just like yourself.
Then we fight to become King Dork or Queen
precisely.
Dork.
Precisely, yes. But the idea of people that you know have already watched it, who knows how many times, but they want the fuller experience of getting it, you know, blasted into their eye holes.
Accompanied by sugar and saturated fats. Very important.
You can't go wrong. You can't go wrong. But I will say that this time around, at least here where I am in the Northeast, the number of theaters picking it up was a little sporadic. So head over, find out where you can track it down, because it may not be the same theaters that you might have caught the last simulcast. Mm-hmm. So check that out very carefully.
Yeah, in the U.S. you'd check phantomevents.com. In Canada, it'd be cineplex.com.
Yeesh. So, but when we convene for next week for episode 304, we're going to be, at this point, right on the doorstep of The Woman Who Fell to Earth. So I figured it might be kind of interesting for us to be able to just sort of speak from the heart a little bit about the culmination of everything that we've been getting so excited about over the course of the last full calendar year at this point. Mm-hmm. And just make our sort of statements about this isn't a matter of our expectations. This isn't a matter of our predictions. This isn't a matter of our wish list for the season to come. This is just kind of our personal take and statements to our doctor. Almost as if, and maybe you can sort of take this as your walk away homework. And listeners, feel free to do the same, because we'd love to get your input on this as well. If you had the opportunity, similar to this kind of moment where they turn the camera on some fans at a convention and ask them to send a message to Jodie, this is essentially our point of doing that, because there has been so much emotion and tumult and everything else involved with bringing us to where we are going to be in, you know, roughly 10 days time. Oh my God, 10 days time.
Not to freak out.
No, freak out. Fully freak out. Get the Muppet arms going. This will be our opportunity to do that. So it may be a little bit on the shorter cast, unless we have a bunch of crazy news, which is very possible because it's coming at
us. Yeah, it's coming hard and fast now.
Yeah. So, we'd love to have your involvement on this as well. So maybe I'll put the call out in the social media networks to get everybody's sort of take about their message, the incoming. So, and in a sense, you might want to sort of append to that your message to the next. You know what? I want to alter this. I'm literally, as I'm standing here, I'm thinking about this. Your message to the new fan.
To the new fan. Oh.
The someone who finds this show as a result of our next doctor and is sort of maybe sort of taken sidelong by everything that the legacy of this program is. So think, ponder both of those things for a couple of days, guys, and gather your thoughts on it. And listeners, do the same, because we'd love to get your input, because you are as much of this a part of this as we are, if not more so. Yeah, right. We're in for a lot of feels.
Oh yeah, it's coming. All right. Well, this has been episode 303 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, everyone, remain calm. I've got this under control.
And this is Gear saying, now I shall play you my requiem, my Floriana requiem dedicated to Linnaeus.
Oh, God, make it stop. This is Charles saying that you may have noticed that the doctor got the quote wrong when Scorby talks about when it comes to money, everybody is of the same religion. He quoted, the doctor said it was from Franklin Pierce Adams. It wasn't. It was Voltaire. Ah.
Wow.
And this is Haley saying, aggressive rhubarb.
We'll see you guys next week.
And we'll see.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com. Tell us on Twitter at Gallifrey Radio or on Facebook at facebook.com/Gallifrey Public Radio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You should also go to GunnaGeek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows, or visit forums.GunnaGeek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community.
What do you have the Slackbot program to respond to?
Finish the episode is the trigger phrase.
Oh, God, I love it.
That, incidentally, is genius.
Yeah. I literally had to, like, pull a spaghetti noodle from my sinuses because I snorted when I read that.
I'm thinking that really what it should just respond to is anything. From Haley.
I have valuable contributions to make, you assholes.
No. Just set a timer. And if Haley says anything at all from like 8 p.m. forward on a Monday night.
Yeah.
I could just schedule Slackbot to just say every couple of days, "Hey, Haley, have you watched yet?"
Oh, now there is an idea.
And the answer will be no.
Go back to sleep,
Slackbot. Don't tell me what to do, Slackbot. You're not my supervisor.
You're not my real dad.
Haley is a free elf.
All right, Slackbot gives Haley a sock, and then we have to cancel the podcast because at that point, she's got nothing else to contribute.